This is Gay Williams, May 17th, 1993, Elders of the Tribe.
Gay Williams, with a PhD, will speak this evening about older women speaking. Apparently, she's going to give us stories. She is a Jungian analyst from the Jungian Analyst North Pacific, living on Orcas Island.
I hope everybody can come. And now I'd like to introduce a member of the program committee, and he will introduce our speaker. This is Kimbrough Bashir.
Thank you, Kate.
Wow. Hello.
Okay. I wish there was a better way to say thank you than have to wait. Thank you for all these times you stood up here, Kate. That's such a good job. Our guest for tonight, who is at the end of the cycle in our theme of the seasons of life, she will speak about elders tonight, elders of the tribe. And Gay Williams is a Jungian analyst in private practice on Orcas Island. She has a PhD in psychology, right? Yes. And she is a graduate of the C.G. Jung Institute of Los Angeles. Gay told me a very interesting story about someone that she was she admired and studied under, the famous American psychologist Carl Rogers, and she was studying with him in La Jolla at his institute there with several people, and she wanted to get to know him a little better. So she one day he asked if there was anyone interested in house sitting who liked to garden, and she
doing is not to overwater something, and so I didn't water it, and it kept getting drier and drier, and I thought that it somehow I'd overwatered it and I shouldn't water it anymore, and it died. And so when Carl asked that question, I really didn't know anything about gardening, and I was thinking about that story last night and remembering that we did begin to, we would go around looking at, he was very interested in cacti and succulents, and we would go to rare places that had rare plants. And one time we went to one and he saw a small cacti that he wanted to buy, and it was $20. And he asked the man when it would bloom, and the man said it wouldn't bloom for 10 years. And Carl said, well, I don't think I'll probably be around that long, much longer, and so he didn't buy it. As it turned out, I reminded him of that when at his 84th birthday, and it had been 15 years since he missed seeing the bloom of that cacti. And it reminded me then of a letter from Colette's mother that she writes in the first part of Break a Day, and I thought I would just read it because my mind had picked up on that image, and it's a lovely one. She writes to one of Colette's husbands, "Sir, you asked me to come and spend a week with you, which means I would be near my daughter, whom I adore. You who live with her know how rarely I see her, how much her presence delights me, and I'm touched that you should ask me to come and see her. All the same, I'm not going to accept your kind invitation, for the time being at any rate. The reason is that my pink cactus is probably going to flower. It's a very rare plant I've been given, and I'm told that in our climate it flowers only once every 4 years. Now I am already a very old woman, and if I went away when my pink cactus is about to flower, I am certain I shouldn't see it flower again. So I beg you, sir, to accept my sincere thanks and my regrets together with my kind regards." And Colette said a year later she did die at the age of 77. So those small things bear paying attention to. I'd like to say two things about myself before I get started so that you can be at ease. I have a familial tremor, and so I shake. Don't feel like I'm going to fall out or pass out from fear or nervousness. I am a little nervous, but the familial shake is something I've lived with all my life, and so please just relax and don't be concerned about that. The other thing is that I have a dry mouth syndrome, and I'll be drinking a lot of water. I would like to tell you a little bit about how I came to this project of interviewing older women who are Jungian analysts in this country. As the story about Carl reflects, I learn best by experience. I have not ever learned very well by reading books. And so I'm going to be essentially telling you my experience, not my knowledge. I'm not a thinker, and also this is sort of a collage of images in terms of how I'll be presenting to you. In 1987, I was in the midst of what I call a soul crisis. I don't call it midlife crisis because I've had several. and so I call it a soul crisis. My marriage had ended in Southern California. I had left a full-time practice there and left my own personal analysis there. And I had chosen to move to one of the islands here in the Northwest. I chose the island because in the sort of fragmented state that I felt myself to be, it felt like a good container. It felt small, and it felt manageable, and it felt like a place that I could begin again. There's a fragment of a poem from Lars Gustafsson that says something like, "Where is the island that forces us to begin again at the beginning? Forge tools, plow fields, fire clay from the vague memories we carry with us." And I chose an island literally to begin again. I learned to chop wood, and I lived in a small cabin there, and things were very basic, and so it made it very easy for me to just be over a period of time and not put much energy out. I brought what I could bring in my car, and that meant one box of books instead of a library of books, and I promised myself not to buy any for a change, and that was just to save money. One night when I was reading the introduction to John Gardner's Myth of Gilgamesh, I happened to read some words that struck home for me in a way that none had ever before. And I immediately went off to the library and ordered the full text of those words. It turned out that it was a Gnostic text. Actually, it's not a Gnostic text. It was found among Gnostic texts and is a text of the Nag Hammadi Library. It is a revelatory text by a female entity. And I'd like to read the first part of that text because it's related to the rest of the work that I've done. This text is called Thunder Perfect Mind. It was excavated in 1945 from Nag Hammadi, Egypt. And it was, as I say, it was found among Gnostic texts, although they don't know where this text is from. It certainly does not seem Christian. The Isis cult was still alive at that time, and it may have some bearing on that, although I've found some Vedic references that also seem to relate to this text. I was sent forth from the power, and I have come to those who reflect upon me, and I have been found among those who seek after me. Look upon me, you who reflect upon me, and you hearers, hear me. You who are waiting for me, take me to yourselves, and do not banish me from your sight, and do not make your voice hate me, nor your hearing. Do not be ignorant of me anywhere or any time. Be on your guard. Do not be ignorant of me. For I am the first and the last. I am the honored one and the scorned one. I am the whore and the holy one. I am the wife and the virgin. I am the mother and the daughter. I am the members of my mother. I am the barren one, and many are her sons. I am she whose wedding is great, and I have not taken a husband. I am the midwife and she who does not bear. I am the solace of my labor pains. I am the bride and the bridegroom, and it is my husband who begot me. I am the mother of my father and the sister of my husband, and he is my offspring. I am the slave of him who prepared me. I am the ruler of my offspring. But he is the one who begot me before the time on a birthday, and he is my offspring in due time, and my power is from him. I am the staff of his power in his youth, and he is the rod of my old age. And whatever he wills happens to me. I am the silence that is incomprehensible, and the idea whose remembrance is frequent. I am the voice whose sound is manifold, and the word whose appearance is multiple. I am the utterance of my name. John Campbell was asked in one of those BBC series of how he would describe God, and he said, that which the tongue cannot name. After reading this, I thought, what would it have been like had I risen every morning of my young girlhood and said these words? It would have been a very different story, I think, for many of us who had no female archetype to back us up, to stand behind us. And I began to reflect upon that. I began to reflect upon the images that had informed my life. And I would ask you to do the same thing tonight. I think it's to follow your own experience in terms of what your own, how you have been informed in your life. I came upon two, and I'll say them to you because, in fact, they are contained here in this piece of I Am the Whore and the Holy One. My mother decided to send me to Catholic school when I was 6 years old. Now, she believed that if the Catholics got you until you were six, you were had. And that was sort of the equivalent of becoming a warthog or something. It was the most horrible thing that could happen to someone would be to become a Catholic. But she believed that in our town in Kentucky, the Catholics had the best education system, which she wanted me to have. So I think she thought that since I was already six, I was out of danger and had a strong enough will to resist anything that they might try to seduce me into. So I was sent to Catholic school, and about 6 weeks into school, our nun took us to the cathedral in town. And as soon as we went into that cathedral, I was just transfixed. There was holy water, there was darkness, there was incense. The light was coming through these incredibly beautiful windows that told stories. And I remember vividly the nave where the Blessed Mother stood, and that there were fresh flowers at her feet. And so I went home and I said, I want to become a Catholic because I can get the gold key. I can get the key to the gold box where they keep the baby Jesus. And she immediately took me out of school. That was that was my career in my Catholic education. What happened was that that image stayed with me forever. And I would sneak into the Catholic gift store when we would be in town, and she would go shopping. And I would buy little plaques or statues, and I would take them to this attic crawl space that was in our attic. And it was there was a crawl space just big enough for a little girl, and I could go through the crawl space, and then there was a wider clearing, and I could build altars there. And I made altars of nests and eggs and feathers and my plaques and candles in the attic. It's a wonder I didn't burn the place down, but that stayed with me. And the only other image that I had of a female entity was my grandmother, who was a foot washing Baptist, and she would go out to the country church once every 3 weeks. And I remember she would wash both of her feet before we would go, and then she'd put her stocking on one leg, and then she'd put her other one in her purse. And my grandfather would have to drive her because she didn't drive, and he hated to do that. He was Presbyterian Republican, and she was foot-washing Baptist Democrat. And he didn't like to go, but he would drive out there, and it took us about an hour to get there. And the preacher would preach all day long. It was horribly boring. But the one thing that I waited for was the ritual, and it was the communion, when they would all go up and there would be 12 chairs, and she would sit down, and then someone would wash her foot, and then she would put on her stocking, and then she would get down on her knees and wash the person's foot next to her. Now, in my child mind, I thought that was Mary Magdalene washing the feet of Jesus. I understand, since I've become an adult, that sort of, that wasn't so, that was the Last Supper when the disciples washed each other's, or when Christ washed the disciples' feet. But I believe that that was Mary Magdalene, and I was very taken by that ritual, and in later years wrote a short story that includes what my girlfriend and I used to do in order to try to understand this figure, which I'll read just very a little bit from. After one special Sunday, Liddy told how the church people washed each other's feet, about the story where a bad woman had washed Jesus' feet after he was grown, and that he had saved her from her sin. She'd done it with her hair, too, which was real weird to Ellie, but they made lots of it at the church. One day after school, Ellie Mae and Liddy went down to the woods before going home. They sat next to the creek, and Ellie Mae asked Liddy to show her how they'd done it in church. "Well, just put your feet in the water, Ellie Mae, and I'll rub them for you." "But that's not how she done it, Liddy. You said she done it with her hair." "Well, Ellie, everybody don't want to muss their new hair on Sundays, just the day after having a new do and all." Ellie Mae stood staring into the mud seeping up between her toes and said, "I want to do it to you, and I'm going to do it proper-like, the way that woman did." She leaned out over the creek, her knees holding to the mud on the bank, and sunk her whole head under water. Then, crawling on all fours, she went back up the bank. Libby was sitting on a mossy green under the shade of a big hickory. She hugged her knees to herself and laughed. "You look like a sopping old dog, Ellie Mae. So what? I bet his feet wasn't near as dirty like yours. I'll have to wash my hair after I wash them. That wouldn't hurt nobody but the lice. The smell on your feet kill him in seconds. Now tell me how it was. He surely wasn't sitting on the ground with his pants showing." Ellie was still on all fours, her head hanging down, dripping, as she tried to turn sideways so to see Liddy and at the same time hold up her only school dress with her elbow to keep from catching it under her knees. "He was sitting at the table eating supper," Liddy said. "It was the last one before he was going to die. Like how they did down at the prison when they executed that murderer, remember? They asked him what he wanted to eat for his last supper. He could choose anything he wanted. Think of it, Ellie Mae. What did Jesus pick? Catfish." Ellie dropped her dress then, put both hands on her hips. She sat back on her bare heels and asked, "Why didn't you tell me that before I got my head wet, Liddy? We don't have nothing to catch one with anyhow, and I ain't eating it raw. Come on, I'll set over there," pointing to a tree that had been struck by lightning and fallen not quite level to the ground. Ellie said, "You're going to be eating something." Liddy got up and took down her lunchbox from the crook of the tree she'd been sitting under. She'd learned from past experience not to leave it on the ground. All kinds of varmints and critters found their way into there. "I got a used-up chicken leg in my lunchbox. Is it enough for me, too?" "Nah, she didn't eat nothing anyhow." Liddy felt sort of sorry to say it. She almost always carried enough for Ellie. Liddy's mama usually put extra in, knowing Ellie seldom had enough lunch to fill her. "Okay, Liddy, get it. My head's cold." So Liddy sat up on the log, staring out across the creek, nibbling on the chicken leg. Ellie Mae picked up one foot and leaned into it. "She sure must have had awful long hair. I can't see and do it at the same time. You do it, Liddy, but don't pull none." "I can't eat then. I'll hold it for you." So that's how they worked it, with her head still down and Liddy rubbing Ellie's hair around one foot then the other. Ellie asked, "What did she do so bad, Liddy?" "I can't tell." "What do you mean? I won't tell nobody." Liddy hesitated. She rearranged herself on the log, looking off down toward the railroad tracks and scrunching her face up decisively. Then she said it low, like if she didn't, the woods might hear her. "She let men put their thing in her, you know." Ellie Mae raised her head up and shoved back her hair with the hand that held the chicken leg. "I ain't washing no more feet, Liddy. I'm heading out home. You told me to tell you. I didn't tell you to tell me that." "It's God's truth, Ellie Mae. It says it clear in the Bible." Ellie Mae knew she was caught there. She didn't have no Bible, only some of what was left to one. So those were the two images that had most strongly informed me and confused my own relationship to the archetypal feminine as I understood it at that time. Later, as I talk more about the older women, you'll find that Mariana Teich, who's an older analyst in New York City, would talk about the red thread that had run through her life. And these are the images that continue to run through. And very often, those women also spoke of the opposites that begin in early childhood and go on through one's life. I have been influenced all of my life by older women. I'm not quite sure why. I had an older woman friend who was blind when I was an adolescent, and I would go visit her. She had been blind for about 25 years. And I remember one of the last times I visited her, I went to the door, and I heard voices inside the room, and as I went to the door, the voices stopped, and she came to the door, and she would put her hands on my face and say, "I'm so glad you're here," and she would have this look of joy. She was 92 years old at the time. And I remember walking in and saying, "I heard voices," and she said, "Oh, that's the Grapes of Wrath." I was playing the book from the library for the blind that she could get from Washington, D.C. at that time. They were records at that time. They hadn't come out in tapes. And so I went in, and she said, "I'm almost finished with it." She said, "I don't know how many times I've read that book." And I said, "Well, why don't you finish?" And she said, "No, I'd like for you to read it to me." And she said, "It's the last scene." She said, it's one of the most beautiful scenes in all of literature." And so I read it. It's the end of the book where Rose of Sharon and her family she has just given birth to a stillborn baby, and they are looking for high ground because of the flood, all the waters, and the flood has come up in the car where she had the baby, and so they had found a barn, and in the barn there was a dying man in the corner, and his son or grandson was with him. "Hush," said Ma. She looked at Pa and Uncle John standing helplessly gazing at the sick man. She looked at Rose of Sharon huddled in the comfort. Ma's eyes passed Rose of Sharon's eyes and then came back to them. And the two women looked deep into each other. The girl's breath came short and gasping. She said, "Yes." Ma smiled. "I knowed you would. I knowed." She looked down at her hands, tight locked in her lap. Rose of Sharon whispered, Will you go out?" The rain whisked lightly on the roof. Ma leaned forward, and with her palm she brushed the tousled hair back from her daughter's forehead, and she kissed her on the forehead. Ma got up quickly. "Come on, you fellow," she called. "You come out in the tool shed." She herded them through the door, drew the boy with her, and she closed the squeaking door. For a minute, Rose of Sharon sat still in the whispering barn. Then she hoisted her tired body up and drew the comfort about her. She moved slowly to the corner and stood looking down at the wasted face, into the wide, frightened eyes. Then slowly she laid down beside him. She shook his head. He shook his head slowly from side to side. Rose of Sharon loosened one side of the blanket and bared her breast. "You got to," she said. She squirmed closer and pulled his head close. "There," she said, "there." Her hand moved behind his head and supported it. Her fingers moved gently in his hair. She looked up and across the barn, and her lips came together and smiled mysteriously. After I'd read that, Mrs. Royster sat in her chair silent for a long time, and she sighed, and she said, "You know, I've often wondered if I'd ever been faced with that kind of situation, if I'd had the courage to do that." And I said, "What do you think?" And she said, "I don't know." But that's one of the most powerful images of transformation in all of literature. And it stayed with me, I think, just because of her relationship to that and her gift of giving that to a very young girl at that time. I had the privilege later in my life to meet the poet Peggy Pond Church when she was 84 years old, and we began a correspondence about our creative writing. She has published several books of poetry, and it was during the last 6 months of her life, and I had asked her at that time what her task was since the age of 60. She says, "Certainly since age 60, my task has been more and more to cultivate an awareness of death. The poets are a great help, which to me more and more takes on the aspect of a birth. I have often laughingly said that what I want when I come to die is a good midwife to attend me. I experience this phase of my life in my better moments as a kind of pregnancy, as though an embryo were developing within, which is being prepared through the marvelous changes of nature to assume a viable post-human life. I have always been fascinated with the metamorphic changes in the insect world. Within the pupa or the chrysalis, the form of the caterpillar is completely dissolved into a sort of fluid, and then the butterfly or moth aspect takes form. Also, I marvel at crystals, which also form out of a fluid state. I suppose the invisible predetermined form is something like what we call an archetype. But all this happens unconsciously in the vegetable, animal, and mineral forms of life. And humans can be more or less conscious of the process, I suppose, and experience it voluntarily. Our task is to submit to what is going on. Submission has been my lifelong and often fiercely resisted task. Who knows what we have to finish before we are given our leave to die? Now I seem to be called on to forsake my extroverted life. A friend once told me that reading was extroverted. I had never thought so, but I think she was right. When I moved here, I had a fantasy of living free of possessions, monastically, but now faced with the task of giving most of my books away, I see I was far from it. So this morning it dawned on me that learning not to read is a little similar to learning how to read. And I think of the ages of history when man experienced his world well enough without reading. An article about Indian rock art I looked at yesterday spoke of how little we really know of the life of the prehistoric people, except what they left behind shows that they understood very well the life of the spirit and the work of the mind. My analyst and I agree that my dreams show I'm getting ready to die and that I will know when the time comes. Meanwhile, the getting ready is a deepening experience. For some odd reason, I have been thinking of those queens in the days of Henry VIII, imprisoned in the Tower awaiting execution. I saw the Tower of London on a beautiful sunny day with ravens strutting about the courtyard and milk bottles set outside a door. I was deeply moved by the small Romanesque chapel and thought of all those who must have knelt and prayed there with very different religious convictions than ours and with who knows what terror and anticipation. I do not feel at all like a condemned prisoner, but like someone rather happily waiting passage on some Celtic ferry ship. I want to read Peggy's last letter. "Gay, darling, I'm so sorry, but this is my D-Day. My physical condition has become intolerable. My spirit is more than ready. I just need to dive off the end of the board as I learned to do at camp. Only I am choosing the hemlock method of pills and final sleep. My friend knows and will keep heart's vigil for me tonight. The ferry ship is waiting. I have been listening to T.S. Eliot's Marina on tape over and over. Resign my life for this life, my speech for that unspoken. Do not be afraid. Trust the self, the innate wisdom of the psyche. Know that I've carried you in my heart since May. My friend," and she gives me her address, She has all my dream material that since June I have more and more clearly pointed out this way. I know that tonight I go to experience annihilation, which comes to us all one day. I am glad to go as far as I can consciously. The rest is silence. My love, Peggy. No matter what, I've thought about this letter so much because I realized how much I got from her and her correspondence and in knowing her. And I wanted her to stay here. But I also felt such a legacy, such a dignity in her choice and in her way of saying goodbye. A few days later, I got a message from her daughter-in-law that she had died, and they sent a coda to one of her poems, which says that Peggy had written and left to be read at her memorial. And it said, "Now I, old willow tree from which the birds have fled, through whose branches the sap no longer rises, leave my own vacancy on the waiting air." It was soon after this that I came to Orcas, and at the same time that I had read The Thunder Perfect Mind, I started feeling like I wanted elders in my life. And I thought, who can I talk to? I really was resisting, I was resisting anything psychological at that time. And I walked a lot and did very basic things. And what I wanted was to talk to someone older than me, that I felt like I was at the end of my life and I couldn't imagine life after 45 or 50. And so I started thinking that older Jungian analysts were at least accessible to me. And I didn't want to talk to them about their relationship to Jung. I wanted to talk to them about their experience as women and as women throughout their lives. But especially I wanted them to say to me what their life had been like at midlife. And so I called all the institutes in the country and said, who do you know over 70 years old? And so they gave me these names. And I think there were about 10. And I wrote to all 10, and I got one phone call from June Coonan in Santa Fe. And she said, oh, we have lots to talk about. She said, when I was your age, I went to a hut in Ireland and lived for a year. And so I said, wonderful, I can't wait to meet you, and I'll call you back and arrange a time to fly down and talk to you. And in the meantime, I didn't get nobody else called. And so I wrote to June and said, I don't know what to do. Maybe you're the only person I'm going to talk to. This is what's happened. Nobody is called. And she wrote a letter back that was very interesting to me. She said, I am wondering if the lack of response which bewildered you may not be due to the mother aspect of the situation, or perhaps the elder tribal formulation. I'm inclined to think that something new in the world is happening. Women and men seldom lived beyond the menopausal age in the past. Many are doing so now, and they are leaving the family orientation. There is life after motherhood, either symbolic or literal. Life after grandmotherhood also. There aren't guides in mythology or fairy stories or any place in the past for this phenomenon because it didn't exist. Flora Maxwell's book on age speaks to this condition. It may be also that all of us women analysts get mother projected on us so much that we have to disidentify with that constellation, just as we do any archetypal projections which occur in our work. I just think you might get more people willing to talk with you if you posed questions which didn't assume a maternal aspect. You may be still looking for the mother or the grandmother, but the women you want to talk to may be past that aspect. I'd suspect that many of them are exploring new territory and are simply not interested in what they already know. And that turned out to be true. I wrote another letter, and I don't remember what I said, but I got several responses by changing my way of going about things. When I did talk to June, I followed up on the question I had about her going to Ireland. And I'll read that part of our interview. You spent a year in Ireland when you were middle age. I would like to hear more about that time for you, what it meant to you. June said, I had been depressed and had split from the university where I was teaching. I felt that I had to get out of this culture. It had been so intellectualized. Most of the men on the faculty were married. None of the women were married or had children. I went into a castle at Dalkey, which had been turned into a hotel. My goodness, you could hear the sea under the floor. I asked the manager if she knew of a place that I could rent. I wanted to keep house. I liked doing the dishes and mundane chores. They're very satisfying to me. She sat me down and said she would get Mrs. Murphy, whereupon Mrs. Murphy, whose first name was Bridie, for Bridget, came out, took me by the hand and said, you need a cup of tea. And she took me into the round tower room, and Mrs. Murphy took over my life. She had more energy. At that time, she was 65, and I was close to 50, and feeling very fragile. And she said to me once, sure now, when I was your age, I was feeling very fragile. And she had energy that would take me 2 or 3 days to recover. She said, you have to do your writing and I'll see to certain things. And she did. She found me a hut in the forest, and 2 hours after I met her, I was driving with her down through the glen and the downs to the cottage, which had to be remodeled for me to move into. It had been used, I think, to keep stock in, and from then on I didn't make any decisions on my own. If someone suggested I go someplace, I went. And if we didn't get someplace, it was probably where we were meant to be anyhow. Mrs. Murphy recognized your fragility and her own. What was that about? June says, I think the fragility had to do with menopause, the general kind of physical upheaval that takes place at that time, and the restructuring of one's life in some senses because the feeling of no longer being productive in that particular biological way has to translate into being productive in another fashion. And I have to say she certainly was, without the benefit of analysis or anything else. She ran both of those hotels, and I couldn't boil an egg in her kitchen, and she would feed 150 wedding guests out of that. She was also very much tuned into the wee folk, the fairies, and she had the kind of relationship through her Catholicism. She was always trying to get St. Anthony to do something for her, like not having it rain till they got the corn in. She was exceedingly intuitive and psychic. Of all the people that I've known, she was an individual. She was individuated, but that's true of all of Ireland. They are not mass-produced. You would see pen and ink to draw them. You wouldn't use pastel or soft pencil because they were very well defined. There was also an immediate intimacy, even among strangers. Just as well. The greatest development was from 9 to 10. Then she went on and talked about the opposites in her life and the earlier images that had informed her from childhood and that she described came along through her life, and she called her red thread. The opposites in her life were of her mother and her father, of trying to hold them together and of giving gifts to one and giving gifts to the other and being afraid that if she let go of either end, she would fall into an abyss. I asked her what her work was at this time of her life, and she says, "Oh, I've been working on my mother again." So it doesn't stop. I say to her, "You're saying that those images that for many years tore you apart are now coming together. Is that right?" Mariana says, "Exactly. Also, other opposites have come together. This world and the other world, not all together, but as much maybe as possible. I have the feeling maybe I might experience more the reality of the mystery entering into the real world. For split seconds, saying I know is silly because we don't know, but as much as I can. I don't want to speculate. I don't want to be thinking intellectually. I want to wait until it comes to me, whatever comes. That feels good, because I've nothing to say anyway. That's the truth. We might never find out. Our minds might not be for that." I say, "But you continue to follow the red thread." And she says, "I have no choice. I cooperate as much as I can. To speculate is very dangerous, because you think you know and you have no idea." I spoke with her in the last 3 or 4 months, I guess. It's been a while. And I asked her at that time what time of her life has been the most transformative, and she said, "Right now, right now." The next person that I talked with, and the last person I'll talk about tonight, I haven't transcribed all of the ones, and actually there were only 7, I think, that I talked with of the women. Some people felt like they really didn't want to talk about the work that they were involved in right now, that it was taking up all of their energy and their time, and which became more and more clear as I talked to each of them, that, and Jane Wheelwright said it especially well, I think, in the sense that how did she put it? Like the physical limitations were actually welcomed in the sense that it was caught, she was able to say no now. She didn't have to be in the outer world. She could pay attention to what was being given to her from the psyche, from the unconscious. And so in several cases I would hear, this is not the death knell, it's a call to a new sort of life. This is Jane Wheelwright, who lives in Southern California, she lives in Southern California right now. In her late 50s, her grandfather owned like 39,000 acres of land from Dana Point to San Luis Obispo or Santa Barbara. And in her late 60s, that land had to be sold. And Jane rode her pony across the land and wrote a journal for the 7 years that it took to sell that land. She kept a journal in terms of trying to imprint that land and that wilderness on into her life, and so that she could carry it with her. I was born in 1905, and the sale took from 61 to 67.
That gave me plenty of time to try myself out on writing. If I had been 30 or 40 years old, I wouldn't have gotten off the ground. I think I was reaching the age, my 50s and early 60s, when there could be a second life crisis, a time for change. The first crisis is supposed to come around 35 or 40 or earlier, as it did for me, making the early 60s about the right time for a second one. I work with people in this age bracket, and they are prone to say they are at the end of their lives. They have not accomplished anything, and who are they anyway? I could speak to them out of my own experience, telling them that's the time to start on another phase, perhaps the most creative time of a lifetime. Most of my patients believed me. That's when the inferior functions begin to pop up. These functions begin to want to be heard from, and if they're not listened to, they can create trouble. A lot of people don't realize what's happening. They have no way of knowing it's nature's way. It's not a psychological discipline. If you're good at one thing, you've got to live the other thing too. I mean that other thing that may have been your secret ambition in adolescence. For me, at first, it was writing, and now it is writing about nature, using what psychological knowledge I've gained through the years. There are two strands. I have been trying to reconcile them in my recent writing. They are the opposites again. I think I have at least temporarily got a glimpse of the workings of nature as a huge live entity of herself who brought man to his or her present state. It doesn't sound as though psychology and nature were ever split in you. Jane says, one, nature was unconscious. The other, psychology, was very articulate. My mother didn't know much psychology, but she was sounding off all the time. But I think I was influenced by what she said. I must have been. Then, as I got old, I could not help bringing the opposites together. I'm 83 now, at an age when most people check out. I don't feel death yet, but it can't be far away. And the psyche seems to want to bring the opposites, nature and psychology, in fact, all sets of opposites together. I ask, would you see that as your task now? She says, well, I've got enough work to do for another book. I've got enough to keep me busy for a while. But being a sensation type, the here and now thing is important, although I have some access to the other functions, and they also tend to pair off. Perhaps old age in general, instead of my type, wants to get the opposite strands together. And if there is any creative theme that wants to come through when the opposites are together, it can. The opposites make a kind of gateway for whatever energy there is in the unconscious that is ready to come out. That's what opens up the creativity in old people. They must get over their prejudice that they're not potentially creative, that they can't write or paint or whatever. They tend to think the young people are privileged and pass them by in the world of achievement. Old people need to know they need not compete with the young because they have different messages to deliver. They speak out of a lifetime of living. I wanted just to read a little. I say to her, you're still working at the age of 83. She says, I still see about 3.5 people. I say, the half sounds interesting. And she said, the half patient comes only once in a while. They're all artists. I asked, was that by choice? She said, no, it just happened. I'm not an artist at all. I guess I'm more of an intellectual. But I don't think I can practice more than one more year. I say, I've noticed that we don't tend to retire. She says, no, not if we are still breathing and not if our marbles are still with us. As old people, make some sort of projection which has to do with the old woman or the old man who are supposed to be wise. Their projections do not mean one is necessarily at all wise.
but supposition is enough to attract the projection. I say, yes, I have that projection. That's partly why I'm doing these interviews. And Jane says, well, maybe, but a lot of questions don't get answered. So many issues are beyond us, no matter how old we are. I would like to end by reading a poem by Denise Levertov, who is, I think, in her 60s. This is called Dream Instruction. In the language root place, a wooden hall, homestead, warm Homeric Beowulfian shelter, candles are glowing, shadows in rhythm rise and fall. Into this haven have swept, blown by gusting winds, figures whose drama makes a stage, for a while, of place and time, enthralling attention, prompting action, so that my mind meshes itself in their story, until with promises, tears, laughter, they sweep out once more into night. Ruefully, life, I stammer, as the wake of their passage ebbs and vanishes. It rushes and rushes toward me like Niagara. I don't have time to write it down, to hold it. It never pauses. And she whom I address, the old mother sitting in bed, cheerful, sprightly, cushions behind her, saucer in one hand, porcelain cup in the other, sipping her fragrant tea, smiles in wisdom and tells me that need will pass. She herself has come to live in what happens, not in the telling. She quotes to me what a woman born in slavery said when she was free and ancient. I sit here in my rocker evenings and just purely these. The vision of mighty falls bearing down on me still, thundering in my mind. I see a crimson candle guttering, flaring, and another too, whose wax is an amber yellow, almost the gold of its flame. Colors of passionate life. I recall out, brief candle. Shall I snuff them? Leave them. They'll still themselves as the air hushes. I think of the travelers gone into dark. They were only passing through, I say, surprised to her, to myself, relieved and in awe, learning to know those oncoming waters rushed through the ions before me and rush on beyond me. And I have now as the task before me to be, to arrive at being, as she, the old mother, has done in the root place, the hewn wooden cave, home of shadow and flame, of language, gradual stillness, blessing. Thank you, and I guess there's a break, Kate, or... talked about was how in her later life the opposites seemed to be coming together in her dreams as well, and that her dreams were becoming much more anonymous. That was interesting. That the figures in her dreams were not personal. Yeah, more archetypal. Well, like for Jane, she talked about nature and psychology. She spent the first half of her life as a psychologist or an analyst. And in her 60s, when she tried to reconnect with the land that she was grown up on. She became very interested in ecology, and she's written two books now, one called The Ranch Papers, which is actually more from her journals of what she found as she was traveling across the ranch those 7 years, and then a recent book called The Long Shore, and it is on ecology and psychology. Yeah, she felt like that finally brought together for her early experience of the wilderness and her relationship to her mother, who was a psychologist. And that had been a very strong split for her. When she fell into the unconscious in her 30s, she had a crisis following the birth of her son when she was in Europe. And that's how she got to Jung. She went to him for analysis when she was in a postpartum to me, something like that. And what she worked on with Jung was the fact that she was transplanted to England and it wasn't her land, that she had been raised in the wilderness in this country. And Jung was very interested in that, in what the wilderness meant to people who lived there, who were born there, that it's such a different landscape than Europe or England with the hedgerows. And Jane even said, I think that's what Jung was writing about. You know, he didn't say that, but he was writing about the wilderness of the psyche. And so that became a very strong element or aspect of her psyche that she needed to feel grounded in and to understand. And so that was one of her threads through her life, was her relationship to the wilderness and then to that academic life that she had inherited from her mother's side of the family.
I was so struck by the words from the one heaven that you were reading, reason what happens, not in its telling, and just purely, what was the quote, something like she was, what came to me when I heard that was how wonderful it must be to not have any need for any illusions anymore, to just be, and not have to have a whole bunch of overlays to all of
that. Yeah, I think so too. Maybe that's what we come to finally. Wheelwright. Yes. Okay. Without exception, they were feeling that these were very creative years. And also without exception, they were glad not to be out in the extroverted world. They were turning inward and feeling that was a very rich experience. With Mariana Teich, I think that what's going on with her now is that she is approaching the greater self and she's experiencing the mystery. I wrote this a couple of months ago. I look into my mirror at almost 50 and wonder if there is in me anything left of innocence, any virginal place that looks out upon this world and sees it as simply as what the mirror sees. climbing up onto the knoll and down again through bracken and moss, I come upon a young doe, her body fallen over the downed tree, on the run, and I think to myself, dogs, the dogs, like the adolescent boys I once came upon, tying a living bird to the emblem of their carhood. And I wonder at the numbing capacity that the mind has to turn away, not to see what is there, nor to look into the mirror and see them in me. The dogs and the boys and the deer and the string wrapped around the neck of the bird and the silent woods without its bird song. The mirror does not reflect the shadows that grow like bramble over the heart. And yet there is some incumbent presence like a demon lover hovering, always ready to take one down through the darkened valleys of one's own self and to forge there what is true and terrible. The 50s, Jane talked about as a time when she thought a lot about death and that she didn't think much about it afterwards, after the 50s. I've found myself thinking about death a lot in the last few months. What she did was she started working with a woman who was dying of cancer and drew close to what concerned her most. And then as she got into her 60s and began writing about her experience with the land, she picked up a whole other life, creative life. You know, my sense about it, about her, was her willingness, and on each part for these women, like with June Coonan, who went to Ireland, was a willingness to follow what the image was at the time, no matter how hard it was, the pain of it, or the, you know, it was as though they had the willingness to trust that inner urge and in a way pull away from the collective expectation of what they, the life that they had been living. That's my take on it, was that they were very individual about how they approached those years. I agree. I don't know why I did that, why I decided 70 instead of 50 or 60. I think probably because all my peers are about my age and I figured we were all lost in the soup. Didn't, and I think that was, to, in a sense, what June Coonan was talking about. They were more interested in talking about their lives now, you know, other than June's time in Ireland, as well as Jane's time in her 30s during that crisis. She certainly did mother, and she was married, and I think that those years she felt very attached to, and she enjoyed them. I think in terms of the I have found in my own experience that what I'm doing a lot of is reflection in terms of what has gone before, and evaluating that experience and those images as a kind of preparation for moving on. came up in terms of opposites, the early images of opposites that for each of those people, like with Jane, the wilderness and Psyche, and with Mariana Teich with her parents, the parental split, were the really strongest images for her, and the longing for God. Active, but they're more vague. They're not as pronounced, not as clear, and not of the same interest in a personal way that they weren't once were.
That's encouraging to me because I don't know where, somewhere I'm
looking for how we can be reflected by those who have gone before us and have experienced life before us. That's a lovely statue if any of you all get here.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.